listeners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today, listeners, we bring you a mostly fishy program.
Yeah, that's unusual. We don't get fishy programs all that often.
No. But we actually have some coming up, but we haven't done the interview yet.
There we go. So
there seems to be a sudden interesting fish of fish books.
Well, there's a major interest out there among fish lovers in particular, a concern about the disappearance of wild species.
Oh, sure.
And one of our oldest friends who is very involved with all things to do with foraging and wild stuff.
It's Langdon Cook.
Langdon Cook actually felt seriously enough about it that he wrote a whole book about wild salmon and the fact that, sadly, unfortunately, it might be slowly or in some cases quite quickly disappearing from our lives. So start off with today's program.
Langdon Cook. Langdon Cook, I must say that we don't miss often one of your research projects because they're always so thoroughly researched, they're so thoroughly presented that it's a big chunk of information to trip over, you know. But this one, well, of course, I'm very fond of salmon and all kinds of aspects. This book is called Upstream, Searching for Wild Salmon from River to Table. Which I guess is a new term now, from farm to table, is from river to table. And you've written all these other books as well that we've interviewed you about. But this one ties together a whole bunch of different elements, including mythology, human development, mystique. Name some of these threads, the cultural threads, the natural threads, all of these.
Sure, I try and weave together natural history, culinary lore, outdoor adventure, and really what I'm doing is taking all these threads, which might seem individual in their own right, and weaving them together so that ultimately the reader can see the fuller tapestry. The idea is really to show why wild salmon are so important, have been important, throughout, you know, human history in North America.
And that has been the case. I mean, tell us a little bit about that. Why is this such an important fish?
You know, this is a great place to start because basically the first Americans were potentially lured to the continent by salmon. In fact, a new paper just came out from a scientific journal that posits that it was really salmon and the abundance of salmon that drew people across the Bering Land Bridge back, you know, 17,000 years ago, when much of the world's water was locked up in ice and sea levels were much lower. So they could cross from Asia to North America and then make their way down the coast. And this paper posits that it was salmon, really, that lured the people because that was the main food supply. And they could then expand out through the continent once they were here. But this goes back, you know, millennia. And you have places, for instance, in the Columbia River Gorge, which marks the boundary between Washington State and Oregon,
yes,
that represent the longest human settlement in North America, you know, 10,000-plus years.
So that makes and these a lot of sense that this is the reason, right?
Yeah, these are fishing sites.
Yeah.
And so as the ice, a lot of there were places, in fact, the Columbia River is one of them, the Fraser River in British Columbia was probably another, that were essentially refugia, for salmon. That is, they were refuges while much of, the Northwest was locked up in the ice. These were places where the salmon could still survive during the last ice age. And as the ice melted, they expanded out from these places. So the Columbia Gorge or the Columbia River was one of these basins where salmon were able to hold on. And then as the ice retreated, they expanded their range back up, you know, into Alaska and elsewhere. And just at a time when there were people who were spreading out through the continent who depended on them. So our lives, that is humanity, and salmon are really intertwined on this continent. And that's still the case. We still have cultures that are subsisting on salmon and that have all sorts of ceremonial, rites that are based on the life cycle of the salmon. When you think about it, you know, we are probably more closely tied to salmon in North America than any other wildlife.
It's interesting. Does this have anything to do with the fact that salmon somehow figured out a way to do things that fish obviously can't do?
Yeah.
which is climb up salmon runs and get upstream. I mean that's a pretty remarkable thing to do. Men and women can't do that.
Right. You know, the term is anadromy. So salmon are anadromous fish, which means that they're born in fresh water, but then they migrate out to the ocean, out to salt water to mature. And when you think about it, especially, you know, over the last many thousands of years of their evolution, there was all sorts of geologic activity on the Pacific Rim. I mean, volcanoes and earthquakes and ice ages. And so with all this tumult on the land, you know, seeking shelter out in the ocean was one way to survive. And then, of course, you know, when it was time to spawn after a few years in the ocean, if they returned to find that, you know, a volcano had erupted and that their spawning river, you know, was completely deluged in mud and debris, then they would just go somewhere else. And so salmon actually have this sort of straying mechanism kind of built into their genome. So typically they will return to the rivers where they were spawned. But a small percentage of all salmon stray to other watersheds. And in this way, they're able to kind of move around and continue to sort of expand their range with the changing times.
Now it's interesting. Salmon isn't unique to the Pacific Northwest, though. I mean, salmon exists and runs in rivers in my native land in Scotland, which is a little north of part of England I come from. Salmon fishing is something the very rich do, and they protect their right to do it very carefully.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, is it the same fish?
Well, so we have Pacific salmon and Atlantic salmon.
Right.
And at one time, you know, they're all from the same family. But the Pacific salmon and the Atlantic salmon diverged perhaps 20 million years ago.
Okay.
It's sad that you're right that we probably, most of us have never even tasted real wild Atlantic salmon.
That's right, because, you know, for the most part, wild Atlantic salmon are gone. They're really just a shadow of their former selves. I mean, there's still a few hanging on in more remote areas of the North Atlantic. But in New England, and I'm from New England originally, and I grew up, you know, not that far from the Connecticut River, which was historically an Atlantic salmon breeding river. But, you know, the Connecticut River hasn't had a viable spawning population perhaps since the American Revolution, which is ironic.
In
New England, you know, salmon is considered sort of a traditional 4th of July meal.
Yeah, you talk about your grandmother.
That's right. So my grandparents lived on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and they would always have a big salmon feast. They called it their Independence Day salmon at their cottage on Cape Cod, and they'd invite all the extended family, and we'd go up to see them. And that was really my first taste of salmon. And they did it the traditional way, which was in New England to have, you know, a baked salmon with green peas, you know, both spring foods. And then my grandmother would make this little tureen of egg cream sauce. It was a little bit like a hollandaise sauce that she would pour over the salmon. And that was my first bite of salmon. And I have to say, most of my cousins weren't really too interested in salmon. It's a pretty strong flavor, and a lot of kids aren't ready for it. But I immediately took to it. And as a result, I got to sit at the big table with all the adults while my cousins were shunted off to the card table in the corner, you know. So my earliest memories of eating salmon are really connected to having a seat at the table.
That's interesting.
And so this goes way back for me. But as I write in the book, it wouldn't be till years later when I moved to the Pacific Northwest as an adult in my early 20s and had, you know, went to a barbecue and had some Chinook on the grill that I realized that all those years we'd really been eating an imposter, because that was farmed Atlantic salmon that we were eating, not wild salmon. And I suppose, you know, when I was younger, I suppose I just figured it, you know, it was caught by some crusty Massachusetts fisherman, you know, off the coast somewhere and hauled in, and that my grandmother went around the corner and bought it at the fish market, you know. But in fact, that salmon was probably raised, you know, from eggs in a sanitized egg tray, you know, over in some Scandinavian country, and then hatched, and as fry, you know, the fish were transferred to a net pen in a Scandinavian fjord where they were fed a diet of, you know, fish pellets and antibiotics, and even given chemical colorants to change the color of their flesh.
Right.
Yeah, most people don't realize that.
No, I thought that was really odd.
That's right. You would, the flesh of farm salmon would naturally be gray because they're not out in the ocean, you know, as predators. They're just being given this these fish pellets. And so they're also colored. The flesh is colored to match, you know, the consumer's, what they expect.
Yeah.
And really, it's just an imposter. And now, you know, what was started over in places like Norway has been duplicated all over the world, Chile and Australia, New Zealand, both coasts of the U.S. and Canada.
I mean, people will acknowledge that wild-caught is the best of the best, but at the same time, they say that salmon farming is probably the most successful operation in farming seafood.
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it, you know, whether it's dollars and cents or the environmental impact or how many people you're feeding. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to look at it. Actually, I would say, from my perspective, that shellfish farming seems to have the best future, because I think the environmental impacts are lower than, say, with salmon farming.
You mean like shrimp?
Remember that,
like shrimp?
Well, it depends on where the shrimp are being farmed also. I mean, I wouldn't buy farmed shrimp from, say, Indonesia. I mean, they're just absolutely loaded with chemicals and antibiotics. And they're terrible environmental costs. I mean, they cut down the mangroves to put in these shrimp farms. And the same is true with salmon. So let's just go through a few of the environmental costs.
Okay.
So originally the big fear was that these farm salmon, you know, would escape from their net pens and try to spawn with wild salmon and thus, you know, dilute the wild genetics in the process.
Right.
And that's still a fear, but now there are even more major concerns, including the fact that these salmon farms are just, they have very crowded conditions. It's factory farming. The salmon are all crowded in there. And so they're just ripe for both parasites and disease.
Mm.
And so what happens is, and this is especially true on the West Coast, you have wild salmon populations that have to migrate past these farm salmon operations, and the young fry, the young smolts of the salmon that are migrating from where they were hatched in the rivers out to the ocean, have to pass by these salmon farms, and they're catching all kinds of diseases and parasites as well. There's a type of parasite called sea lice, and it's a naturally occurring parasite. When I go salmon fishing, like I caught a salmon yesterday, in fact, just off a beach in Seattle. Yeah, nice silver salmon on a fly. Lots of fun, about 5 pounds. And it had a few sea lice right near the tail, which I just brushed off. But, you know, these smolts might be only a few inches long when they're heading out. And as they go by the salmon farm, they might just get covered in sea lice. And so now they're starting to think that some of the declines, for instance, in Fraser River sockeye might be connected to to these salmon farms that are popping up. So that's a concern.
Mm.
Another concern is that, you know, they're fed on fish meal. Salmon are predators. They eat other fish and,
right,
and krill and things like that. And so I think it's something like a pound and a half of fish pellets, of fish meal, to produce 1 pound of salmon meat. Okay? So you are taking fish from the ocean. You're taking more fish, in essence, to produce these salmon, which are essentially a luxury item. And really, you're taking fish that might be on the menu in poorer countries. So there are social costs to this as well. You're taking small fish, you know, herring and anchovies and things like that, but those fish might be on the menu in other countries, in poorer countries, to produce the salmon, which is essentially a luxury item. So there are a lot of reasons to be skeptical of salmon farming. The other thing is that, you know, from a culinary standpoint, we've already talked about it. Wild salmon is superior both in flavor and texture. But the other thing is it's we don't really have to do anything except ensure that the wild salmon have pristine habitat or, you know, simply just acceptable habitat.
You see, you brought up an issue that we've kind of just jumped over is, as we know, the salmon prices are going sky high, and that's because of scarcity and so forth. What are the kinds of things that we have done to destroy the salmon's natural habitats?
Well, this is at the heart of my book. It's really about the tension between civilization and the wild. And so we've seen the decline of Atlantic salmon on both sides of the Atlantic. And it basically moves from south to north up both coasts, so in northern Europe and in the U.S. And, you know, it's really a function of population, human population, that is, and our impacts and, you know, urbanization, agriculture, timber harvest, mining, hydropower. The list just goes on.
It's like everything we do.
It's like everything we do to create our civilization. And so to basically lead more comfortable lives, essentially. And so the same, you know, effects are happening now on the West Coast with Pacific salmon. And you know, where I live, obviously hydropower is a big deal. And so the Columbia River Basin, which used to be the Columbia River was the greatest salmon producer on the planet, most biologists agree. And it's a fraction of its former self. And that's largely due to the hydropower complex. So we have harnessed the productivity of the river for energy and not salmon at this point. But, you know, our cities, our pollutants, you know, all the timber cutting and mining and agriculture, all these have major effects. So I live in Seattle, and obviously, you know, Seattle has a salmon culture that goes back centuries, if not millennia. And Puget Sound, up until fairly recently, was loaded with salmon, even as late as the 1950s. But the trend has really been downward, and the last couple of years have been rough here in Puget Sound, and we've had fishing closures, and salmon runs are way down. And then the other thing, and we should probably get into this, is that most of the salmon are hatchery salmon, as opposed to wild salmon.
Right.
And that's true of the Columbia and elsewhere up and down the West Coast. So just to sort of put this into some context and explain it for your listeners, imagine a spectrum that begins with, say, wild salmon at one end and then farmed salmon at the other end. You know, those are completely domesticated. They spend their entire lives in net pens. They never see the ocean. They never behave as true predators. So you have those at either end of the spectrum, the wild and the farmed. In the middle, you have these hatchery salmon, okay? So hatchery salmon, we produce them in hatcheries, But then we let them go, and they head out to the ocean, and they live like wild salmon. They have to survive on their own. They have to eat. And then they return at the end of their journeys out in the salt to their hatchery, because salmon have these homing instincts. So they come back to the hatchery. Maybe they get caught by a commercial fisherman or a recreational angler, or maybe they make it back to the hatchery. But they're not quite wild. Even if they behave in some ways like a wild fish, these are fish that are being engineered by human beings, and they can't possibly exhibit all the sort of genetic diversity that wild salmon have. And we have essentially replaced our wild runs with these hatchery runs. And that is to keep our commercial fishing industry going, to give sport fishermen something to catch. We've done it for essentially economic reasons. But the thing is that hatchery salmon just don't survive in the wild as well as wild salmon. With wild salmon, we don't have to do anything. We just have to give them good habitat. Nature takes care of the rest. With hatchery salmon, we have to spend millions of dollars, and we have to, you know, continue to try and keep those runs alive. That's kind of where we're at right now. We have a lot of hatchery salmon. We have a few wild salmon that are hanging on, but they're on the ropes. And the question is, what are we going to have in the future?
Yeah, well, that is the question.
Yeah, and most advocates for wild salmon would say we really need to wean ourselves off the hatchery. Mm-hmm. It's been good for our commercial fishing industry and for sport anglers, but if we want to have salmon in future generations, we need to start protecting our watersheds more and giving wild salmon a place where they can live and thrive. And here's the thing. Unlike most popular forms of seafood, salmon live among us, at least for part of their life cycle. They're spawning in rivers all around us. And so when you think about it, anything that's good for salmon is probably good for us too. You know, clean water, quality habitat, fewer pollutants and chemical runoff and all of that kind of stuff. Really, by making the world safe for wild salmon, we're making it safe for ourselves.
You know, we should probably address you actually go in the field and meet the people involved. You have all these interesting characters in your book, and you're an outdoors person. I mean, to yourself personally, right?
That's right. Yeah, my wife thinks it's a racket. You know, by day I'm out in the woods or along the waterways, and then at night I get to have these amazing meals with different chefs who are preparing the wild foods that I'm out there hunting. So, it's a lot of fun. I get to go to some pretty far-flung locales. You know, to write the book, I traveled between Alaska and California and east to the mountains of Idaho, and I spent time in places like Cordova, little community in Alaska right near the Copper River that has no connection to the road system. So either you fly in or you take a boat in, and you're surrounded by beautiful mountains. And then I spent time in the wilds of Idaho, in the Sawtooth Mountains, and down in California. So I got to travel to some pretty neat places.
Well, you sound like it's a good life, though. I mean, if people want to really understand it's a very complicated situation. You've reduced it to maintaining the habitat, but even that is really kind of difficult, isn't it, for keeping our salmon?
These are really difficult issues.
Yeah, but your book lays them out, and if somebody's really interested in the subject, be sure to get Upstream, Searching for Wild Salmon from River to Table by Langdon Cook. And I want to wait to hear what you're going to attack next, because you don't do anything half-baked, do you?
You know, I'm thinking about it right now, and I can tell you that it will involve, you know, going deep into the wilds somewhere, and I'm hatching some plans. But at this point, it's all under wraps.
Okay, you can't give us.
Yeah, Mrs. Cook doesn't even know.
I can tell you that. I can tell you there will be a wild component to it for sure.
So you don't take your wife with you on these adventures?
Oh, you know, she benefits. I've been bringing home a lot of salmon lately. and of course, with my previous book, The Mushroom Hunters, our you know, fridge and our dehydrator was just loaded with mushrooms around the clock, it seemed like. In fact, she has now bought me, for Father's Day, she got me what she calls the forager's fridge. So now I have my own refrigerator because she's just so tired of, like, trying to find space in our kitchen fridge, you know, to put the normal stuff in.
Oh, yeah. Well, you have access to all those wild mushrooms. And you know what I crave from time to time is morels. You just don't get them fresh here anymore.
Yeah, we had a pretty good morel season this year.
You should have, all that rain, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, morels and spring Chinook, boy, that's a great pairing with a little, you know, Willamette Valley Pinot Noir reduction to go with that.
Oh, now you've got me, Langdon. I'm really, I'm jealous.
That's a Northwest treat right there, for sure.
Well, guess what we're having for dinner tonight?
Oh, no.
Are you having some salmon?
We're having salmon, but it's not Copper River, only because we're not the 30th employee of Microsoft.
Yeah, right. I know. Well, who can afford that these days, right?
Exactly.
Right.
You have to. You're fortunate. You can go catch it for yourself.
Yeah.
Well, I do feel very lucky, and you know, it's pretty amazing being able to live in a big city like Seattle and catch a salmon inside the city limits. I really appreciate the fact that we can do that. And I write about it in the book because we do have this industrial fishery here, and, you know, I'm surrounded by container ships and tugboats, and you can see the skyscrapers off in the distance, but it has sort of its own eerie beauty to it. And listen, I don't want to trade civilization. I'm perfectly content with it, but I think what we need to do is bring ourselves back into some form of balance with the natural world. Because after all, you know, all the really good things in life are provided by nature. And I think we need to remember that.
Yes, I agree.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and bringing us enough of your story to get people interested in having their own copy of Upstream. I'm glad we have ours. And thank you so much once again for joining us at On the Menu. I hope I'll talk to you again soon.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you both. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks, Langdon.
And we'll be back with another fishy story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, we're going to be talking next to Susan Schett, who did a really nice job. Really, really. It's called Reel Masters, and it's not R-E-A-L, it's R-E-E-L. In other words, she has profiled some rather important chefs, some very important chefs who actually also fish.
And you just happen to have an interest in recipes for fish. Dishes,
right.
And of course, they're what's in the program. They're what's in the interview. Sorry, don't know what I'm doing here. Better start the track, right? Susan Schacht, Reels and something or other?
Masters.
Reel Masters. Well, listen, are we going to get down to business here or not? Because John has to talk to us quickly, and then has to rush off because he's opening a restaurant somewhere in Florida. And the purpose of this group is convened, and we have Susan Schott. Did I have it correctly, Susan?
Correct.
Schott.
Who's associated with the publicity for a book called Reel Masters.
Yeah.
No, and that's not R-E-A-L, it's R-E-E-L, Chefs Casting About with...
Timing and Grace. I don't know why you're reading this upside
down. All about catching fish. And the funny part about it is, it's really strange, we should be starting off this interview with John Currents, from Oxford, Mississippi, where he has a wonderful restaurant called City Grill. He says he doesn't like fishing. Why are you in a book about fishing when you don't like fishing?
Did you catch the correction?
I did. I was more interested in going on to what I read about John, which is that he doesn't like bass fishing.
But
he goes anyway.
I hope at this day and age that the irony to that quote, you know, amongst thinking people is not lost. I really do adore fishing, but mm-hmm. I love catching way more than I love fishing. Uh-huh. It's like, you know, just like bird hunting. I really like to go bird shooting more than I like hunting. I'm one who like enjoys the social implications, you know, of my sporting activities, you know, particularly when they come at the expense of lesser species. But, you know, I would prefer to make short work of the, of that matter at hand. I've never had the patience to be an angler. And I think there's a difference between anglers and fishermen. I mean, they're guys that like truly do, you know, appreciate the art of learning how to fly fish and have the patience to actually work the fish and wait and so on and so forth. I just want to go out there and catch them and get back to the kitchen or the live fire as quick as I possibly can. And drink beer and cook what I've caught.
See, I thought fishing was mostly about drinking beer and smoking cigars.
I think I definitely fall into that category.
You're one of those too. But you, this book is composed not just of people who like to fish or don't like to fish, but who happen also to have fine restaurants. But it also introduces a whole set of characters who are guides to those people who would like to fish more. And you have a particularly interesting character called Nash. Not G-N-A-S-H, Nash, N-A-S-H, which I think used to be an automobile, but now is someone who's in the fish guiding business. Tell us a little bit about that. He seems like a real character.
He is, but so many of the guys that have peopled my life in hunting and fishing guides, is a man who is, on the surface, he's very restrained. He employs an extreme economy of, words, syllables, and sounds. loves, his job and takes it so seriously, which is, you know, nothing more than putting you on top of fish and giving you the ability to put them in the ice chest. But getting to know Nash, over the course of the last 20 years has been one of the greater privileges in my entire life because, you know, he just is, delightfully, colorful and smart. He is preceded by, Nashes in at least two generations before him that are, beloved, revered, respected gentlemen in New Orleans. Nash has just sort of become, you know, part of my life and oddly my family. I mean, I think I tell the story in the early part of my chapter, like walking into my parents' house, you know, at some point, which is sort of minimalist from a nostalgic photographic standpoint. And one of the first things that I saw when I walked in the living room was a picture of Nash and his fiance, like their engagement picture. This is almost weirdly cult-like. It's very sort of like Rosemary's Baby's moment, like when I saw it. But he's just sort of that delightful and lovable an individual.
He doesn't sound like the marrying kind. Did he ever actually make an honest woman of the lady?
Well, yeah, no, absolutely, and it could not have been a more, you know, sort of a more perfect and strange marriage. He ended up getting married to one of my father's best friends, to a young lady who was, you know, in a number of different carnival organizations when she made her debut, and, you know, a very sort of typical old money New Orleans family, and you know, but her love is in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and which is where she has a a seasonal business planning weddings, and you know, is very much a dependent woman of that has made her own way. At in her mid 40s, just secure enough, on her own that she and Nash ended up sort of being match made by a couple of old men, and put together, and they fell in love, got married, and it really is a perfect sort of marriage, because Nash spends well over three quarters of the year on the water taking people fishing, mornings that start at 3 a.m. And wrap up at about 2, and Elizabeth spends a significant portion of her time still out in Jackson Hole, planning weddings, and so, they adore each other, and they're together when they can be, and they make their lives otherwise, and, it is the most, sort of beautiful marriage, slash marriage of convenience, which, I know sounds insulting, but, it's just the most, workable marriage that I've ever seen. It's just it makes complete and total sense.
And didn't they, John, meet on a fishing trip? Didn't they meet when she went on the guided trip with Nash?
With
Harry?
I would lie. My brain is such a kind of half rotted scrambled eggs right now.
Okay.
I'd be a liar if I took it for sure.
Well, I was just going to say that there are two things. We keep interviewing these southern chefs, and the two things I don't understand is I don't understand about the guides, and number two, I don't understand fish camps, but everybody seems to have one of each.
Yes, we do. And a lot, I think, if you look at it, a lot of guys will, attribute some of their greatest interest in learning how to cook at time that they spent at those fishing camps, because, where at my age, there still was sort of the, misogynistic order to life. Where,
like Chris Hastings.
Cook.
Yeah, and his father,
right.
Can I mention, by the way, that the photographs are splendid in this book, and ideas are very poetic that are expressed by each of the featured chefs. But you also have some really great recipes in here. And yours, John, the smoked trout dip really struck me as good.
Well, and that's, it's interesting because, I've my family's vacationed over on the panhandle of Florida, since, about 1966, 1967, when there was really nothing over here at all but government land. In little fishing villages, and I remember, sort of as a kid, my first taste of mullet dip was smoked mullet dip was kind of the big thing over here, because mullet was a sort of this plentiful fish that was oily and it turned in a hurry. There wasn't a whole lot you could do with it. You didn't just fillet it and eat it, and so it became this center appetizer piece. As a smoked dip, and I just loved it as a kid, and and as a chef, at some point in my life sort of harkened back to it and went, oh crap, you could use any kind of fish in this, and what if you used really, really, really good fish in it? And so, trout and redfish being plentiful, as, the two things that I really love to fish for in South Louisiana, or catch, I guess, we're sort of continually coming up with, trying to come up with new and fresh, ideas for what to do.
Tell us about your English pea velouté.
Oh, God.
Do you catch that, too?
I think that a really well-executed velouté is sort of the equivalent of, if you could eat velvet in whatever flavor that you wanted, that, that's what you get in velouté. Peas are plentiful at the time of year when I love to fish the most. And that's only in a tiny varying degree, because I love to, to be on the boat year round, but, I just love being out there in the springtime. And so, just to have peas with some greens and a nice lightly, sauteed piece of fish. It's just,
You top
or
this
with smoked fish.
You top this, the soup with flaked broiled trout, creme fraiche, and fresh herbs. Well, I mean, what could be wrong with that?
Look at me. It's like I know what I'm doing.
With John's chapter, because we're coming up on Father's Day here, he has a beautiful tribute to his father in his particular, you know, all the chefs wrote their own narratives with their own voices, and he has a beautiful tribute to his father, which he mentioned earlier about building your team and always getting the best people around you to help you in all of your endeavors. And I think it would be a disservice not to mention that tribute to his father at this time of year. It's really very special. So we thank you for your words and your wisdom, John, and appreciate your time.
Well, thanks. And we don't, you know, we haven't spent even a moment thanking you for, you know, giving all of us the opportunity to, you know, to share our voice on these, you know, these little things in our lives that we love that, you know, most folks would, you know, would never know or care about in the pages of, you know, of your books. And, you know, I can't think of anybody, you know, the ancillary bits or in our business directly that, you know, that I love working with more, talking to, or, you know, or being around than you. And so, you know, just one more time having had the chance to put something in one of these books and be part of one of these projects that, you know, ends up being so much fun, you know, just when it gets out there and watching how people react, you know, to these books, it's overwhelming. They're just going away hands down like the greatest, you know, they make for the easiest Christmas and birthdays and, you know, that ever come around every time one of them comes out. So thank you.
Well, Susan, that puts the ball squarely smack back in your court, and I thought maybe you should tell us a little bit about the concept of the book. You have done a number of books, have you not, having to do with sport?
Yes, I have done several books. This is my fifth one, Sporting Life, and this is the second book that's kind of along the model that involves chefs with. The first one was called Wild Abundance, and we used that same model where chefs would go with us to private hunting lodges and private hunting clubs, duck hunting, and their mission was to pay tribute to the time-honored cooks that in many cases had been working with families and club owners for decades and had become part of the family, but no one had really chronicled their time-honored recipes, and in a couple of cases, these cooks didn't read or write, and so called a couple of the chefs that I knew, and they were very eager to help create and chronicle these stories. And so that Wild Abundance book was in 2010, and that was, of course, duck hunting. And I grew up as a fisherman. I always wanted to do that same model based around the fishing stories. So I made a call again to a couple of the chefs I've worked with at Wild Abundance, John Currents being one, John Desch, and Kelly English, and Donald Link, all agreed to do the fishing book as well.
And then how did you select
they were
these guys?
Taking us to their particular gems or secret places and telling their own story through their own words about why fishing and why now and why the sporting life.
Now, you figured out, how did you select the chefs?
Well, so I count on them to help me with that. So the first book, Wild Abundance, was very Memphis-centric. And so we wanted to kind of spread out a little bit and involve more chefs. And so they would it was like old-fashioned party line. And they would call and engage other chefs to sort of be a part of this book. So we decided on 8 would be a really good number. So it really was very easy. I just sent an email out to the 4 chefs that had worked with me before and said, let's go fishing. And then they did all the rest on getting all the other people involved. So it was really quite amazing.
Yeah, well, most of these people we know and have interviewed before, and they have all expressed this very special time, especially in relationship to their fathers, like John Besh and Donald Link, and with the camps and the sport. So, I mean, it's a real connection. It just happens to focus in on the chefs in the South, I think, huh?
Well, actually, you know, Peter Kaminsky, who wrote our foreword, of course, he's in Brooklyn, and he was I'm sure you all know, the former food writer at New York Times for 25 years.
Right, we've interviewed him, too.
Yeah, yes. And, of course, he's as he calls himself, a fishing fool, too. So when we ask him to write the foreword to the book, he fishes still a lot. And he said it took him 30 minutes to say, oh, yes, I really want to do this. So the same themes that are coming through with the recollections of their youthful adventures and boyhood schemes and the growing up with the camaraderie and the competition and the multi-generational spirit of either, and there's some chefs who even mentioned their grandmothers. There's a couple of chefs that mentioned both grandmothers. And so that multi-generational feeling of connecting and ritual and respites and reflections and has come across with them, but also across the country. And I know you mentioned guides and fishing camps, and that, in my experience of doing sporting life books, the guides and the fishing camps and the time together, the concentrated time together, is universally applauded and adored, revered. So,
yeah, well, actually, you know, I mentioned Chris Hastings and his restaurant, Hot and Hot Fish Club, really is a reference to his, I don't want to say ancestral because I don't know how far back it goes, fish camp that he was involved with his father. And,
right.
Yeah, and you have gorgeous photographs, and we should mention that the photographer is Lisa Busser or Busser?
Busser.
And yes. Gorgeous, breathtaking photographs. And the run through the chefs that you cover, by the way, just so our listeners know.
So we have Jeremiah Bacon in Charleston. We have John Besh in New Orleans. Walter Bundy's in Richmond. John Currents, of course, is in Oxford. Kelly English is in Memphis. Chris Hastings is in Birmingham. And by the way, his new-ish restaurant, Oven Bird, is spectacular.
I heard, yeah.
It's really something. We had a big launch party there. It was just wonderful for the book. Donald Lincoln is in New Orleans.
Yeah.
I do, too. He's just so great in so many ways. That was such a special chapter because his father and son were there, and the son, who was 8 years old at the time, you can see from those photographs just the adoration and the love between those three. Of course, Donald grew up at that fish camp with his father, and his grandfather was the cook. He's now inherited that role to cook at the camp, of course. And then Kevin Willman is from St. Louis, but he took us fishing to Pensacola and Orange Beach because that's where he grew up fishing. So he goes back there every year for cobia, which is really quite a unique situation with cobia. You actually hunt the fish. Yes, you're up on that third tier tower looking for the fish, and then when you see them, you come down and then cast out. So
the book covers all of that, and it talks about the expressions are very poetic of each of these chefs and their remembrance and their experiences fishing. And then in addition to having the beautiful photographs, and then you've got killer recipes, really great. And I'm going to get a hold of that John Besh and want to know why, after all these years of eating his food, he never made these stuffed artichokes for me.
That's so funny. It was interesting because it's a very carefully curated group of recipes. It's not often that you find a cookbook where you have eight chefs that are contributing their own special recipes. And I didn't ask them for specific recipes. I didn't say we want it to be fish eccentric. We didn't want it to be, you know, whatever it is they wanted to contribute. Because it's funny, this is true with hunting too. So when you go out hunting or fishing, you don't necessarily have food that's related to that sport. So sometimes they eat comfort food. Sometimes they eat, as I mentioned in Kelly English's chapter, he mentions sometimes they eat ham sandwiches with mayo on white bread. Yeah. It's just whatever they can sustain themselves with while they're out there after their bounty. And so, and then some of them have rituals that they have dinners the night before, or they have family dinners that are repeated, you know, over the decades, like Donald Link has his grandfather's fried bass, skillet fried bass, and he says the only way to cook bass, and it's the first time I've grew up fishing. It's the first time I've ever had bass cooked that way, and it's the only way now that I will, you know, really want to try again.
I think that not only will readers who purchase this book be rewarded with gorgeous stories and images, but they also will be able to follow these recipes for gorgeous food. I can't wait to try the bass recipe myself, Susan. You've done an amazing job with this, and I could tell from talking to John Currens that they all are very appreciative. So let us know when you do your next talk. I'm sure it'll be exciting.
Well, thank you. I have a couple in the works right now, but I did want to mention the other thing about a portion of the proceeds from Real Masters and the culinary arts are conservation. And as a part of that, the chefs contribute all of their time and their voices, their narrative, as a gift to chronicle what they think is a very, very important part of their lives and their stewardship of the land and the water. And they're working to make a difference and support local farmers and train rising chefs and fight childhood illness. So the contributions to their efforts are very, very important because they're philanthropic innovators and entrepreneurs, and they give back in a multitude of ways. I think people don't realize that these chefs, these are celebrated chefs, and they're so busy, and they spend so much time doing good for the communities and other people. And that's a really big story that I think we need to highlight and focus on in a lot of ways.
I agree, absolutely. And you've done a great job, Susan. I thank you again for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
I sure appreciate your time and what you do. We really think know it's important, and so we'll be following along with you.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Susan. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Justin Rosenberg is the CEO and founder of this new growing fast casual chain, I think we call it.
That's what he calls it.
But he calls it that. And they just opened the first Pittsburgh shop. So we talked to him about that and about a concept which is actually just so appropriate to the time when every diner wants to control what goes in their mouth. I mean, it's called
Honey Grow,
and it's HG is the what is on the sign, right, in both lowercase. And most of it's healthy food. It's local as much as possible. It's you control exactly what you're going to get on the latest technology and touch screens. So that it's really an interactive adventure.
It is.
He's going to tell us a lot more about it.
For those of us who barely know how to use our smartphones, this is quite a break.
If you're hungry, you'll be able to use it.
Yeah, it seems like Justin has the pulse of what it is, that people are interested in these days. So if you find one in your neighborhood, go have a good time. And if you're in Pittsburgh, certainly do that just down the street from where we live.
Justin Rosenberg, how nice it is to have the opportunity to say welcome to our city, and not only that, welcome to our neighborhood.
Thank you. Very happy to be in this neighborhood and in this city. Thanks for having me.
And your enterprise called Honey Grow, we'll get you to explain what Honey Grow means. It certainly intrigued us enough that we walked three blocks from OTM home to get here. But that's why we said welcome to the neighborhood. But this has become a sort of like a restaurant row, which it never was when we first inhabited this street called South Highland Avenue. So why did you choose this particular spot? And do you have plans to have more of these spots in the Pittsburgh area?
Yeah, we, well, start with Pittsburgh. Oh, gotcha. Thank you. Really came to Pittsburgh with an understanding there's not much, many concepts doing what we're doing in this city. And we wanted to be first to market with our concept in this city. And when you take a step back and coming from out of town and you really see the changes in Pittsburgh over the last, you know, two decades and even decade and 5 years, it's incredible. You know, as a Penn State person, I had a lot of friends in Pittsburgh and I'd visit all the time. And we were here about 3 years ago and I was completely blown away with the change and the companies that are coming in here and all the insanely amazing things that Carnegie Mellon's doing. And we just, I wanted to be a part of the city, and a lot of, again, a lot of our peers aren't here. So how cool could it be for us to be first to market with what we're doing? And when we came to this area, it's emerging. It's really cool. We have some really great companies in the area, and there really weren't too many lunch options. So we thought it would be really fun to be entering not only Pittsburgh, but entering a market that's still emerging. So we want to be a part of that story.
Now, where did the concept began? At the other end of the state, in Philadelphia, correct?
This is correct. Started in Philadelphia. First Honey Grow opened. It was June 8th, 2012, and this will actually be our 20th location here in Pittsburgh.
You have a really varied background, and I'm just curious. You've studied everything, mainly liberal arts and things like that. I mean, how did you home in on the food business, which is a tough business?
I'm a creative at the end of the day, and you know, I'm a huge music person, and I grew up as a tremendous music person. I had my bands back in the day, and I was steered towards not trying to become famous in the bands when I was a kid by my parents. So I figured, all right, maybe I'll be a lawyer, something completely on the opposite side of the spectrum. But once you have that creative DNA and creative gene inside of you, you are who you are. And I think one of the things that excites me as much as food is music. And one of the things that excites me as much as music is food. And if I can scale something and build a business out of it and spend every single day of my life focused and building something that I'm truly in love with and passionate about and giving something back to our, not our audience, but our guests, that really excites me on a daily basis. So I just want to spend my life doing that. And food is that outlet.
Oddly, one of the things that put East Liberty on the map was the Shadow Lounge, which was a non-alcoholic place to go to listen to great music, but that's long gone. I mean, everything's moved on, become much more expensive in East Liberty. There is so much competition here. You said about lunch, but what else about your restaurant? Explain the concept. Please.
The concept, Honey Grow is a fast casual restaurant, and we focus on freshly made stir fries and freshly made salads. We're buying as local as possible. Our noodles are made freshly made by ramen chefs. We're buying product like Creekstone Farm beef, free bird chicken, organic spinach, organic mezclun mix. We really want to have a quality product, and we also want to be different. So when I created the concept, my goal was to have not only a female demographic, but a male demographic. There's so much competition in the fast casual world. Mexican's been done a million times. Burgers have been done a million times. Salads have been done so many times. How do we create something different? And I'm proud that Honey Grow really is a concept that's differentiated from everybody else. So, you know, you can come get a salad for lunch. You'll come back again, get a stir fry for dinner. I love the fact on weekends our restaurants are crowded with families. I'm biased, but my three kids, my wife and I come in, and my kids inhale stir fries, noodles, broccoli, and chicken, and my wife and I can grab a salad, and it really works for everybody. So I wanted something that was versatile, something that can really hit multiple day parts, and something that was differentiated from the rest of the pack.
How many store shops do you have?
This will be number 20. By the end of this year, we'll have approximately 25-ish.
And how fast do you want to grow?
That's a great question. I get asked that a lot. I want to grow at a pace that we can remain comfortable at, and there really is no set number. If my team ever feels that things are too chaotic or if the quality of the product is being sacrificed, we would slow down. I mean, they would send a red flag. So there really is no rate, but we certainly are so far being able to handle it. We've built an infrastructure to handle growth, and that's pretty much it.
Now, when I read your menu, there was a lot of opportunity for customization. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the number one item that we sell is create your own stir fry with chicken. And after that, it's create your own salad. And people can come in and create whatever they want. You can create something that's gluten-free. You can create something that's vegan. If you have an allergy, we can work with you in terms of that. You can order around that. Our menu is peanut-free. So if you have a peanut allergy, it's totally safe. This is because my wife has a peanut allergy, and it was one of the deals that we made when I said I'm going to start my own restaurant concept. Great, but got to be peanut-free so I can actually eat there. And that was, I've lived up to that promise. So we're peanut-free, and if you have an allergy, gluten allergy, certain sort of diet restriction, the ability to create your own product is great. So we really can work for anyone.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you're really on the mark, on trend, for what everybody wants in this specialized, customized thing. And the food sensitivities just overwhelms me. I never knew of anything like that in my whole entire life. And chefs are, like, tormented at this point.
Yeah, this is true. For me, I'm lucky and blessed in the sense that I don't have a food allergy. And, that's me, but there's so many people who do, and there's people who have certain diet restrictions. I was vegan for a long time, so I was on a fully plant-based diet, which ultimately led to the creation of HoneyGrow, making salads for lunch, stir-fry for dinner, using the same ingredients, cutting up chicken, using it for my salad, then my stir-fry. And, I get it, and it's tough, and certainly it's tough for a chef as well, but the good thing about what we do is the fact that our guests can come in and customize what they'd like.
Well, we've gone around about, but would you please just describe, like in the terms of food porn, some of your most popular dishes?
So, a few popular dishes. I love our spicy garlic. It's one of my favorites. It's old school. It's great. It does well. Our Cobb salad is incredible. Our sauces and dressings are made from scratch. So, I'm very proud of that. We don't have a freezer here. What you see is we're getting orders on a daily basis. I mean, we have a very, very fresh product. We're working with local farmers here. It's a very high quality product. So, really, everything's really good. I love our spicy garlic again. The sweet soy five spice is a really awesome dish. Our fresh egg white noodles are my favorite. So anything with a fresh egg white noodles and a few vegetables, that makes me pretty happy.
I love that you're here, and I thank you for talking to us.
I love to be here, too, and thank you for talking with me. I appreciate that.
So there you have it, listeners. Until the same time, same place next week, when we hope you'll join us again. And until then,
bye-bye.